The last time I saw your father, about 2.5 weeks ago, he talked about Alice a lot. It was something he never really did, so I thought it was strange. He told me that she'd started acting strange toward him. She couldn't make eye contact. She was totally cold. He kept asking her what was going on, but she wouldn't say anything.
It sounds like she found out about you two.
That's what we thought, but we went over it and there just didn't seem to be any way she could have.
There could be 1,000 ways. She could have found one of your hairs on his coat. She could have hired a detective. She could have just felt it, known it.
I know. Like I said, it's why I came here. I had to see her, at the funeral. I thought I might just know from looking at her.
And did you?
I don't know what I know anymore, but I think I should go to the police, tell them I was having an affair with them. Maybe it would make a difference.
You should,
Harry said. I will, before I leave.
That will mean that Alice will know about you.
I guess, if she doesn't already.
She already knows about this other woman.
There is no other woman, Grace said.
Are you sure?
Yes, your father and I talked. I was definitely the only person he was involved with. He was racked with guilt. He said it was the first time he'd done anything remotely like this. Harry felt her eyes on him, looking for confirmation.
I don't know what to tell you, he said. But think about it. He was deceiving Alice with you. What makes you think he wouldn't have deceived you with someone else?
Grace pursed her lips, then said, Because he wouldn't have. I don't believe it. Alice is making it up because maybe she wants the police to look at someone else. Harry felt a little bit of loyalty toward Alice. He said,
Why wouldn't she just tell them about you?
I don't know. Maybe she didn't know about us. Maybe because I wouldn't be a good suspect because I was down in New York City. They were both quiet for a moment. Harry's eyes traced a water stain in the corner of the bedroom's high ceiling. Finally, he asked,
Were you hoping that my father would leave Alice to be with you?
Of course that's what I was hoping, Grace said, her voice loud.
I just didn't know if you saw it as a fling.
I thought it was just a fling because he was married and because he was twice my age and all those other things, but like I said, I was in love with him. We got one another. So yeah, I had fantasies that he'd leave Alice and move back down to the city and in with me. It didn't make me feel good about myself, but I thought about it. I thought about it all the time. She paused, and Harry didn't say anything. Are you mad at me? She said.
What do you mean?
I seduced your father. He was a married man. It's possible that I'm the reason he's dead.
I don't know if I'm mad at you, but I want to know more. About you and him.
You're just like him, you know. You don't talk about yourself. You just keep asking questions. He did the exact same thing. I thought he was selfless at first, but I changed my mind. I think it was selfish. I think he didn't want to give anything of himself away, and I think you're the same.
I don't know what to say to that, Harry said.
Yeah, that's what he used to say, Grace said, her voice tinged with anger. Then quietly, she said, What's the name of this woman he was supposed to be involved with?
Annie Callahan.
How did he know her?
She worked at the bookstore, the one up here. Alice said that my father hired her because he'd heard her husband was out of work and she needed the money.
Harry watched Grace, who was chewing at the side of her thumbnail. He thought she looked doubtful for the first time. He wanted to say more, wanted to convince her that there was a possibility that his father had been involved with two women on the side. Maybe it was a midlife crisis. Maybe it was a pattern he'd had his whole life. Harry no longer knew what to believe.
Grace, he said.
She stopped biting at her nail and looked up at him.
You should definitely tell the police you're here, Harry said.
She shrugged and said, I'll talk to them. They won't believe me, but I'll talk to them.
she started chewing at the side of her nail again. He wondered what she'd done today, if she'd left this room or had anything to eat. He was going to ask her, but instead he said,
I should go. Thanks for telling me the truth about my father.
Stay a little longer, she said quickly, smiling weakly, her eyes locking on his.
No, I should go back, Harry said.
He stood.
Okay, I understand.
Harry didn't immediately move.
Are you going to be okay?
He asked.
I will be. I'll be fine.
I'll check in with you tomorrow morning, okay?
He said.
Bright and early. I think we both need to get some sleep.
Okay, she said, her shoulders dropping. There was a sad smile on her face, and she looked defeated.
Be careful, she said.
I'll be fine. I'll be back tomorrow. We can go to the police together, if you'd like.
Yes, she said. Harry went through the door, shut it behind him, and retreated, hand on a banister, down the dark stairwell and out the front door, back out into the night. Back at Gray Lady, he shut the front door quietly behind him. He could hear gentle snores coming from the living room. He took his shoes off by the door and went and looked over the couch at Alice, sleeping, while another home renovation show, this one with a pair of handsome twins, played on the television. Harry left her where she was and went up to his own room. It was warm and stuffy, retaining the heat from earlier in the day. He opened a window, took off all his clothes, and got under his single sheet. He cracked a book, even though he knew there was no possibility he'd be able to read anything. He stared at the illegible lines of print, and thought about the day, and about how little he'd known his father. Chapter 20. Then. The police returned the next evening. Not Officer Wilson with his fuzzy mustache, but a woman with a perm of tight curls who introduced herself as Detective Mativier.
Sorry to come around during dinner hour, she said to Jake at the door, as Alice listened from the living room, but I have some follow-up questions for Alice.
Jake let her in, offering her coffee that she turned down. Alice had called in sick at the pharmacy and was still in her pajamas and her favorite robe. She wasn't sick, but she really didn't want to be out in public, listening to people speculate about what had happened to Gina Bergeron. They must have been gossiping like mad in Kennewick, because they had already begun to gossip in the world at large. Alice had watched Entertainment Tonight the previous evening, and Gina was the second story. A promising model who had mysteriously died in the ocean while visiting her family. Alice had been shocked when one of the pictures they chose to show was her own favorite picture, Gina in the yellow bathing suit with the sad eyes. Well, they'd picked it because of how haunted she looked, probably. At the end of the segment, John Tesh had said something like, "More to come on this story for sure," and Mary Hart had frowned and tilted her head. Alice had thought, why is there more to come? Another tragic model, drugs, and suicide. What else was there? After Jake pulled up a chair for Detective Mativier to sit on, Alice, settling on the edge of the sofa, noticed that the detective held a small plastic box in her hands. It looked like a square toolbox or a piece of medical equipment. The detective caught Alice looking at the box and said, "It's a kit for making a tooth imprint, Alice." Jake, still standing, said,
"What's going on?"
"Alice, did you bite Gina Bergeron on Friday night?"
"Yeah, I bit her on the hand." The detective looked a little taken aback, as though she'd been preparing for a denial.
"Can you tell me why?"
"Okay. I went to dinner at the Bergeron's house because Gina's mother invited me. After dinner, Gina and her mother asked me to come outside, and then they attacked me."
"They attacked you? Physically?" the detective asked, gesturing. Alice noticed that there were no rings at all on any of her fingers.
"Not physically, but they ganged up on me."
Why did they do that? Alice turned and looked at Jake. His normally placid features registered a small amount of concern. She turned back to the detective. For someone who didn't wear jewelry at all, she wore a lot of makeup. They didn't like that I was still living with Jake. They thought I should get my own place.
Alice, you...
Jake began, but the detective interrupted. Why did they think that? She asked. You obviously know because you've talked with Mrs. Bergeron. She must have told you about the bite, so she probably told you all about everything else.
I'd like to hear it from you, Alice.
They thought Jake was taking advantage of me. It's sick. I have no family left, and Jake is all I have. He's more than a stepfather to me, more like a real father, and they were telling me that I should get away from him. It was crazy. I took off.
Why do you think they thought Jake was taking advantage of you?
How do I know? Gina got it stuck in her sick head, and she told her mother, and her mother believed her, I guess. The detective turned to Jake for the first time and asked, Did you know anything about this?
No, I'm hearing this for the first time. It's totally ridiculous. Alice was my wife's daughter. That's all it is. Alice, why didn't you tell me about this?
Because I didn't want to bother you, because it was disgusting.
So, Alice, Detective Mativier said, what can you tell me about the bite?
Alice breathed deeply through her nostrils. Some of the anger she'd felt that night was coming back, and for a brief moment she could feel Gina's flesh between her teeth. They kept accusing me, and I got upset. We were in the backyard, and I decided to just leave. Gina ran over and grabbed me, and I just took her hand and bit it. I wanted her to let go of me, and it worked.
But Gina came back that night. She came here and tried to talk with you some more, right?
I already told the other policeman all about that. Gina was drunk. She came to apologize and wanted to go swimming as a way to restart our friendship or something. I told her I didn't want to, and she left. That's all that happened.
You didn't go swimming with her?
No, I stayed here. If I'd gone swimming with her, she probably wouldn't have drowned. Does her mother think I went swimming with her?
Instead of answering, the detective asked, Why didn't you tell us the whole story when Officer Wilson first questioned you?
I told you, because I hadn't told Jake about what Gina and her mother were saying. I didn't want to upset him, and it had nothing to do with what happened later. I'm sorry, I should have told you, but I didn't.
That's okay, Alice, the detective said, and looked as though she was about to stand.
So you don't need my teeth? You don't need to use your...
I don't. Not if you're telling me that it was you who left the bite mark on Gina's hand.
She stood, glancing toward Jake, then back to Alice. What does Gina's mother think? Does she think I had something to do with what happened to Gina? Alice asked.
She's pretty upset. She says that Gina hated swimming and would never have gone swimming alone in the middle of the night, especially with her hand the way it was.
She didn't hate swimming. Like I told that other detective, we'd been swimming before.
Okay, the detective said. Thank you, Alice, for clearing up the issue of the bite.
Something in the detective's voice and body language told Alice that she'd just decided that there was nothing mysterious about Gina's death. Alice had passed, somehow. But then Detective Mativier turned to Jake and said, Do you mind walking me out to my car? I have a couple of questions, just for you.
Oh,
Jake said, then nodded.
Sure.
Alice was able to watch them talking in the parking lot from the window in Jake's office. They stood side by side near what was probably the detective's tan car, something American, maybe a Chevy Celebrity. It was a gray evening, the air filled with fine mist, and Jake, wearing only a sweater, stood with his arms across his body. The detective had put on a white trench coat with a big, floppy collar. She seemed to be mostly listening as Jake spoke. She nodded several times, then began patting at her pockets as though she was getting ready to leave. Jake unfolded his arms and held out a hand for her to shake. Then she was pulling out a pack of cigarettes,
offering one to Jake. To Alice's surprise, he'd quit a couple of years ago. He took the cigarette. The detective lit her own with a lighter, then handed the lighter to Jake. After she drove off, Alice watched him stand, greedily smoking the cigarette, and looking out across the road toward the ocean, lined with whitecaps. When he came back in, his skin was damp with the mist from outside, and he smelled sharply of the cigarette. "Why'd you smoke one of her cigarettes?" Alice asked.
"You were watching us?"
"I saw you through the window, but you smell like cigarettes." He sniffed and rubbed at his nose.
"I was just being polite. She offered."
"What did she ask you?"
"Let me get a drink and I'll tell you. Why didn't you tell me about Gina and her mother? Jesus, Alice."
She followed him into the kitchen. "I didn't tell you because who cares what they think?"
"Maybe I would have cared. You have to tell me these things, Alice. I need to be prepared."
"What did that detective ask you?" He poured whiskey into a tumbler, then added some ice and soda water. It was what he drank when he was drinking a lot, what he drank all day on Sunday when there were football games on.
"She wanted to know what our relationship was."
"What did you tell her?"
"I told her it was none of her business."
"Why didn't you tell—"
"She said that Vivienne Bergeron told the police she has proof that we're involved. That one of her friends saw us together at a restaurant in Portland."
"That doesn't mean anything. Besides, who cares, and what does it have to do with what happened to Gina?"
"Nothing. Nothing at all. That's what I told the detective, and she agreed. She says that Vivienne Bergeron is kicking up a fuss, convinced that because they had accused you that night, somehow you got revenge on Gina. She's been talking about the bite and how she knows for a fact that Gina would never have gone swimming by herself."
"That's stupid."
"I'm just telling you what the detective told me that Vivienne has been saying."
"So what does she think I did? Does she think I killed Gina and threw her in the ocean?" Jake shrugged.
"She just lost a child. I don't think she's thinking straight. Can I get you a drink?"
They watched TV. Jake let Alice pick what to watch. Mystic Pizza was on USA, and they watched that, Alice occasionally flipping over to MTV during commercials. Jake went back and forth several times to the kitchen to get a new drink. When the movie was over, Alice turned the television off and said that she was going to bed.
"Wait a moment, Allie. Okay?"
Her body was instantly cold. "Sure," she said.
"I'd like to talk to you about something."
Alice's heart fluttered, and she stood up and said, "How about tomorrow, okay? I'm too tired to talk." She knew what he wanted to talk about. She knew that the police detective bitch had said something to him, and now he wouldn't want to live with her anymore.
"Hey, stop that," he said,
his voice too loud, like it sometimes got when he drank a lot.
"Come here, okay?"
She came over and stood in front of him. She realized she was still in the robe she'd worn all day, and her hair was probably flat and greasy. No wonder he was kicking her out. "You want me to leave?" she said, and jutted out her lower lip.
"Alice, no. That is definitely not what I want. Sit down here."
He patted his lap, and she slid on top of him as he carefully placed his drink on the glass-topped side table.
"What I want," he said, "is for you and me to have a conversation about how we need to be extra careful from now on."
"I didn't say anything to Gina and her mother. They were trying to get me to say something about you, but I swear I didn't."
"I know you didn't. I'm not talking about just you. I'm talking about us. We have to be careful about what restaurants we go to and how we act, and eventually, not right away, you should get your own place." "No, no, don't worry. You should get your own place, even though you can keep staying here most nights."
"Maybe we should just let people know about us. It's not illegal."
"I know it's not illegal, but it's frowned on. And I wouldn't care, except that I have a position at a bank that's important. I advise people in this town on what to do with their money, and they're going to lose faith in me if they think that you and I are together. They won't understand.
What if we got married?
Alice,
he said, then took a long sip of his drink, placing the glass back down with a loud clink.
It wouldn't make any difference. In fact, it would probably make things worse. It's not just that you're the daughter of my wife. It's that I'm 30 years older than you are.
I don't care.
I don't care either, but other people will.
Fine, we'll be extra careful.
That's all I'm saying. We have to be very, very careful from here on out. People hate to see other people happy. Remember that.
Alice went to bed first. She was exhausted, brushing her teeth for less than 30 seconds, then slipping out of her robe and under the covers. She wondered if she was exhausted because of the stress of being interviewed by the frizzy-haired detective, or if she was tired because she'd barely done anything all day. She hadn't gone swimming since Friday night, the night that Gina couldn't make it back. Tomorrow she'd swim again. There were only so many days left before it would be too cold, and then she'd have to swim at the Y with the over-chlorinated water and the old ladies. She lay awake, thinking about swimming, then listened as Jake got ready for bed, standing a long time in the bathroom applying his face lotion, as he always did. He climbed in bed beside her, naked, smelling of vanilla and sandalwood. He kissed her. The type of kiss that meant he was tired, then said,
I was going to bring this up earlier, but I couldn't find the right time.
What? She said, her limbs tingling.
I woke up on Friday night to get a glass of water. You weren't in bed, so I went downstairs to look for you, and I couldn't find you anywhere. I was nervous, so I looked out the window. I saw you coming back from the beach. Your hair was wet.
She didn't respond.
Alice,
Jake eventually said. Why didn't you say something?
When? That night?
Yes.
I guessed that it was something between you and Gina, and I didn't want to bother you about it. I went back to bed. You came in and showered.
I didn't, shh, Jake said, his face pressed up close to her ear.
I don't want you to say anything, but I wanted you to know that I knew. Don't say anything, okay? We're better off, much better off, without Gina in our lives. Just like we are better off without your mother.
Alice's limbs stiffened at the mention of her mother. Whatever you say, she said.
I love you, Alice. Forever and ever, no matter what happens.
I love you too, Jake, she said, and turned away from him. After he fell asleep, Alice got up and went to her old bedroom and got under the covers. She could hear the very faint sawing sound of Jake snoring through the condo's cheap walls. She tried to sleep, but she kept thinking about what Jake had said. Why had he brought up her mother? She'd found her mother dead on the sofa. Something she'd have to live with forever. And now she'd lost her best friend. She hadn't been able to save her, and Jake was making it sound like she was somehow to blame. She flipped over under her stomach, even though she knew she wasn't going to fall asleep. She thought about Jake, trying to erase the words he'd said to her. Chapter 21. Now. The bed was moving, the twisted sheet tightening against his ribs. Harry opened his gummy eyes. It was still night. He was cold, but a warm body was pressed against his back, and an arm had snaked over his shoulder. He heard Alice's voice in his ear. Just keep sleeping, Harry. I don't want to be alone. Harry stayed as still as possible, wondering if he could just pretend to be asleep, but he knew that she'd felt his entire body tense when she touched him. She pulled in tighter. There was some kind of satiny fabric between his body and hers, but he could feel the press of her breasts against his back, the rough edge of a nipple.
"Alice,"
he managed to say. "Shh, go back to sleep. You're so cold." She spread her hand across his chest, then brought her legs up so that her knees touched the backs of his thighs.
"I don't think..."
"Just for me, okay? Go back to sleep." He could smell the wine on her breath. She shifted her body back and forth like a bird settling into a nest. She pressed her forehead against the back of his neck. Harry concentrated on his breathing, keeping it steady. He closed his eyes. It did feel good to have a body up against his, radiating warmth. He listened as her breathing became deeper. He could feel her breath against his skin. His heart rate began to slow. When he woke, he was on his back, Alice hovering over him, lifting her nightgown past her hips. Harry started to speak, and Alice was kissing him, one hand against his neck, her other sliding down his stomach and taking hold of his erection. There was nothing he could do to stop it from happening. His body was taking over, and soon they were having sex. Alice kept her head close down to his, her hair spread over his face, and he shut his eyes, the world reducing to darkness and sensation, Alice whispering his name in his ear again and again. Afterward, he started to speak again, and Alice said, "Don't. Let's not talk about it." Harry, relieved, stayed quiet, and soon Alice's breath became slow and rhythmic. He turned away from her and closed his eyes. When he opened them again, the window had brightened with soft morning light. Alice was still breathing heavily, her mouth now pressed into the hollow between his shoulder and his spine, her lips against his skin. He moved his hips involuntarily, and Alice's fingers fluttered against him. Harry made himself roll away, then sat up on the edge of the bed. He produced a low humming sound to make it seem as though he had just woken up. Behind him, on the bed, Alice stirred. He stood before she could say anything, aware of his nakedness, and quickly left the room, grabbing his jeans and t-shirt from the floor. He went straight downstairs, where he got dressed, and pulled on the shoes that were still by the door. Then he stood still, listening for the sound of Alice getting up herself. He heard nothing. What had happened in the middle of the night now felt like a vague, dusky dream. How drunk had she been? Was there the possibility that she hadn't known what she was doing? Harry opened the door quietly and stepped out onto the front step into the cool dawn. Birds were chattering loudly in the trees, and the front lawn was coated in dew. He sat on the steps, his mind replaying details from a few hours ago. His skin shivered and tightened at the memory. It had been a new experience, giving in to the will of someone else, her body taking control of his. She was smaller than he was, but she'd felt larger as she'd drawn him into her. Harry was desperately trying to file the experience into a folder that made sense, but he couldn't. He'd had sex with his stepmother, less than a week after the death of his father. It felt halfway between a fantasy come true and the type of nightmare you wake up from drenched in sweat. He tried to stop remembering it, but kept hearing her whispering his name in his ear, the edge of her teeth against his earlobe. He had no idea what time it was, but figured it was probably just around 5 o'clock. He decided to walk to the Dunkin' Donuts over in Kennewick Center, get himself some coffee, maybe something to eat. It was over a mile to Kennewick Center, but the walk felt good. He began to warm up, the sun rising, the mist burning off. Approaching the Dunkin' Donuts, he wasn't sure it was open yet, but when he got to the front doors, he could make out an employee moving behind the counter. He got himself a large regular, a coffee with maximum cream and sugar, and a blueberry donut. He sat in a booth, watched through the steamy window as a pickup truck pulled in across two spots. A skinny man wearing a camo baseball cap jumped out of the cab, the truck still running, and strode into the shop.
"Morning, Cody,"
said the woman behind the counter as she got him a coffee and an apple turnover without asking him what he wanted. Harry kept his eye on the truck, spilling exhaust, and had a brief urge to race out of the shop with his coffee, steal the truck, and just start driving north, see how far he could get. But he didn't move. The man returned with his breakfast to his truck. Harry kept sipping at his coffee. He ate his blueberry donut, remembering, as he ate it, that it had been his father's favorite. His thoughts shifted again to Alice and Grace's conviction that she had something to do with the murder. What if Grace was right, and he'd slept with his father's murderer? His stomach flipped. He told himself to breathe and thought of Occam's razor, something he'd learned about in a probability course in college. The simplest solution to a problem is most likely the correct one. What was the simplest solution? Probably that his father had been an adulterer who liked to seduce younger women. He'd seduced a married woman and been killed by a jealous husband. Grace was just another girlfriend who had nothing to do with his father's death. Alice was a betrayed wife who was right now trying to grapple with everything that was happening, and she was desperate for attention and affection. Wasn't this the most logical solution? And if that was the case, then Harry had some responsibility because of what his father had left behind. His hand went instinctively to his pocket, looking for his phone, just to check if Grace or Alice had sent him a text, but he left it in his bedroom. He left the shop with his coffee. The sun was higher in the sky, and there were a few cars along Route 1A now. He decided to walk back home. Later, he would get in touch with Grace again, make sure she told the police what she knew. He walked along the sandy edge of the road. There was a breeze from the east, and the air held the smell of ocean. As he approached Kennewick Village, he was about to veer off toward York Street and back to Gray Lady, but decided at the last moment to walk past the house where Grace was living. It was too early to visit, but maybe if he'd just walked by. The house looked quiet and empty in the morning light. Harry glanced up at Grace's second floor window. It was hard to know for sure, but he thought her lights were on. He walked halfway to the door, thinking maybe he'd knock gently just in case she was up. But then he stopped. The door was open. Not by a lot, but it was cracked by about 6 inches. He almost turned back, knowing suddenly that something was wrong. He stood frozen for a few moments, then continued toward the door. He could peer inside and listen. When he reached the door, he pressed his palm against it and pushed. The inside of his mouth was coated with the cloying taste of the sweet coffee. Grace was on the floor of the foyer, her bare feet pointed toward the door. He knew she was dead, but said her name anyway, his voice no louder than a croak. He stepped through the doorway. She was wearing the clothes she'd been in the night before, a striped shirt and jeans. One arm was flung over her head, the other down by her side. "Grace," he said louder, hopeful. But when he took another step inside the house, he could see what had happened to her. Her skull, on the left side, was collapsed inward, her hair sticky with blood. Her purple jaw didn't line up with the rest of her head, bile rose in the back of Harry's throat, and he closed his eyes for a moment. He took a step backward, felt the blood rushing from his head, and took hold of the doorframe. He touched his pocket, even though he knew he didn't have a phone with him. He took one quick look into the foyer, again, past Grace's body, and saw a phone on a waist-high table. Keeping his eyes on the phone, he went to it. It was an old landline, squat like a toad, and he half expected it not to have a dial tone when he picked up the receiver and pressed it to his ear. Part 2. Black Water. Chapter 22. Now. Caitlin McGowan reread the email for what must have been the 50th time. It was from Grace, her sister, and it had been sent probably just hours before she'd been murdered.
I know you're going to freak out, see, but I'm in Maine. I came up after I heard Bea died, just after we talked. I found an Airbnb and drove up to go to the funeral. I just couldn't stay in New York and pretend it wasn't happening. I needed to see her. Sorry, I know I'm not making sense. I'll slow down. I'm exhausted and wired at the same time, and I've barely eaten today. Bea's son Harry was just here. He came by to tell me that there's now a suspect, that Alice told the police Bea was having an affair with someone in town, and she thinks this woman's husband was the one who killed Bea. She's making it up, and that makes me think that Alice actually did have something to do with Bea's death. First of all, Bea was not seeing someone else. I told Harry that, and he looked at me like I was deluded, and you're probably thinking the same thing. But he wasn't. Alice made it up because she found a way to kill him, and now that the police know it wasn't an accident, she needs someone else to blame. The son is cute. He's an age-appropriate bee, right down to his pure emotional blockage. When I saw him at the funeral, my knees literally buckled, and then I saw the way Alice was hovering over him, and I wanted to swoop in and save him. I went to the bookstore because I thought Alice might be there, and I could see her up close, but he was there, and then I was telling him I was looking for a job. I could tell he was into me, or maybe it was just that he could tell that I was lying about why I was there at the store. He texted me and asked me out for drinks, like a real date. He told me all about his life, and I made up a story about coming to Maine to get away from it all, but he didn't believe it. You know, I'm a lousy liar. So he came here tonight, and I told him everything. And then all I could see was how he was blaming me for what happened to his father, that I started it all, and then I didn't know if I was just projecting my own guilt onto him. I feel like my skin is on fire. I'm so anxious. I just decided to go to the police in the morning and tell them everything. Who knows if they'll care, but then I'll be done with it. I have nothing to hide and no one to protect. And as soon as I do that, then I am hightailing it away from Maine, and look, I buried the lead. L-E-D-E? Can I come stay with you? Not forever, but for a few days. I'm done with New York, and I can't stay here, and I really don't want to move back in with Mom, at least not right now. I know you've told me in the past that I can come any time, but I still wanted to ask. I'll be in Boston tomorrow. You're probably asleep, but write me back as soon as you get this. XOXO. G. Caitlin shut her laptop. She'd shared the email with Detective Dixon, bringing it up on her phone at the station to show him earlier in the day. He'd read it, then asked Caitlin if she could forward it to him. What do you think about it? She asked him.
I wish she'd come to us earlier, the detective said, and his words made Caitlin's stomach hurt.
It must have shown on her face, because he quickly continued,
But who knows if it would have made a difference. It's not a smoking gun. Plenty of people have affairs and don't end up being murdered.
But the fact that Grace got killed must mean that Bill Ackerson was as well, that it's connected.
There's no indication that Alice was even aware of your sister's existence.
Why? Because she says she wasn't?
Can I ask you some questions about Grace?
The detective said, hunching his shoulders forward like he had a kink in his back. Caitlin noticed that he had a scar above his right eye where his eyebrow didn't grow.
Sure, Caitlin said, and settled back into the molded plastic chair. They were at a small conference table toward the back of the station, in a glass-encased room. There was a whiteboard that had been erased clean of all but a few random, smudged words. Names, cell, separate. The detective had brought her here to show her photographs of Grace's lifeless face for the purposes of identification. Caitlin had received a frantic call from her mother early that morning, telling her that she'd just heard from the Kennewick Police Department, looking for identification of a body carrying a Michigan driver's license in the name of Grace Ellen McGowan. Caitlin volunteered to drive up to Maine. During the hour-and-a-half drive, in a state of unreal shock, she'd alternated between bewildered grief and a desperate hope that it was all a misunderstanding. When the detective put the first photograph down in front of Caitlin, she had a moment of pure relief wash over her. It wasn't Grace. The face they were showing her was a young woman, but with fuller cheeks than Grace had, with puffier eyes. Caitlin shook her head. I don't think... The detective placed a second photograph next to the first one. It was of a tattoo, cursive script across a rib cage. Do you realize we're floating in space? As quickly as the wave of relief had swept through Caitlin, a wave of icy recognition replaced it. Caitlin looked back at the face, photographed on a neutral background. Yes, it was her twin. Her features reduced to their basic nature, a nose, two eyes, a mouth. She hadn't recognized the face because there was nothing left of Grace in it. But the tattoo, that silly, impulsive tattoo, some line from a song Grace had loved in high school, meant it was really her sister. She nodded at the detective, and he produced a piece of paper, proof of identification, for her to sign. She quickly glanced over the sheet, not trusting herself to speak, then signed on the line. The detective put the sheet of paper in a manila folder and thanked her, then asked if she wanted to be alone for a moment before they talked further. She nodded, and he left, shutting the door behind him. She cried, a hand across her eyes, for several minutes. She'd cried earlier, when she first got the call from her mother that Grace was dead. But this was different. She'd seen the pictures. Grace, unimaginably, was truly gone.
She was your twin? The detective asked, after he'd come back, after she'd shown him the email, after she'd asked him repeatedly what had happened and why.
Yes.
Identical twins?
No, fraternal. But some people thought we were identical because we looked alike. But really, we just looked alike because we were sisters.
Were you alike in other ways?
Personality, you mean? God, no. Not at all. I was the careful one, and she wasn't careful at all. As you can tell, from the situation and from the email, she was kind of impulsive and didn't really know what she wanted. No, that's not entirely true. She was impulsive, but she always knew what she wanted. It just changed all the time.
Like the way she wanted Bill Ackerson?
Yes.
Were you surprised that she came up here for the funeral?
Yes and no. I just found out when I got the email.
Did you know him?
No. I'd just heard about him. Not even that much, because Grace knew I disapproved. Then she called at the end of last week to tell me that he'd died.
You said your sister was impulsive. Any history of violence, any outbursts, any mental health diagnoses?
Caitlin shook her head no.
How intense do you think Grace's relationship with Bill was?
She was in love with him, Caitlin said.
The detective pushed the box of Kleenex closer to Caitlin. She took a tissue, realizing there were tears on her cheeks.
"Can I keep you here just a little bit longer?"
the detective continued. "I guess."
"I want to ask you some general questions about your family and Grace's friends. Maybe this has nothing at all to do with Bill Ackerson."
Caitlin didn't get back to her room at the Sea Mist Motel until late that afternoon. She sat on top of the shiny bed cover and reread Grace's last email. Then she listened to the three messages she'd gotten from her mother since she'd last checked her phone. She knew she needed to get back to her, to confirm what they'd already known, that the body was indeed Grace's. She braced herself and made the call.
"Caitlin?"
It was her, Mom. It was Gracie. They both cried together on the phone. Then once Caitlin had confirmed that her mother wasn't alone, Patrick was there, like he always was, and her mother's sister, Aunt Nan, was coming over later, Caitlin felt better about beginning the process of ending the phone call. "Mom," she asked, "can you have Patrick call Dad? I don't think I'm up to it."
"Yes, of course, Patrick can do it. You've done enough, Caitlin. I should have been out there with you."
"No, there's no reason for you to be here. I'm fine. Well, I'm not fine, but, you know."
"Did the police say anything else? Do they know who did this?"
Caitlin told her what she'd found out, but left out for now that Grace had been up in Maine for close to a week without letting anyone know. She'd already told her mother earlier about Grace's involvement with Bill Ackerson, a much older married man. Her mother's response had been expected.
"I blame your father."
They talked some more, Caitlin assuring her mother that she would find out when the body was going to be released, she'd forgotten to ask, and how to make arrangements to bring Grace back to Ann Arbor.
"I'll call you later tonight, Mom, okay? I'm exhausted and going to try to get some sleep."
"Okay, don't go out alone. I still wish Dan was up there with you."
"I'll be fine. Have Patrick call Dad."
They said goodbye, then Caitlin lay back on the bed. The air conditioning unit in the window kicked up a notch, and the sound jolted her. She sat up again. As she always did when she was overwhelmed, she made a quick mental list of what needed to be done and in what order. Find out when they would be done with Grace's body. Arrange for the body to be transported to McClellan's funeral home in Ann Arbor. She had their number on her phone. Call Maria at work and tell her she'd be away for at least a week. Fly back to Ann Arbor herself. And once she was there, she could finally tell her mom that Dan and she were no longer together, hadn't been for about 3 weeks. Her mom, who loved Dan and referred to him as her daughter's fiancé, even though he never was going to be crushed. Or maybe it wouldn't bother her, because of what had happened with Grace. But she didn't believe that. She knew how her mom's mind worked, and it was a moment of tragedy, and that meant all hands on deck, and Dan's not being around was going to be a problem. The other problem, of course, was going to be her father. He would have to go to the funeral, of course, and her mother would just have to ignore him. She just hoped that her father would be decent enough to come to the funeral alone, and not bring his new wife and her 3 children. He'd left 14 years ago, the day after Christmas. Until that moment, Mike and Carol, yep, the parents' names on the Brady Bunch, had been together since high school, staying faithful all through college, even though Mike had gone to the University of Michigan while Carol went to Barnard in New York City. They got married a week after they had both graduated. They had 3 children in 2 years, the twin girls, then Patrick. There were no more children after that, and Grace and Caitlin had often speculated on how their parents had managed to find a church-approved method of birth control that actually worked. Then there was that day after Christmas, when Mike called the family together, told them that he was leaving to be with Angela Hernandez, a widow who had 3 children of her own. He left with one bag of clothes, plus his golf clubs. Caitlin and Grace had just turned 11, and they had opposite reactions to the sudden decampment. Caitlin had made a silent list of what needed to be done, dedicating herself to helping her mother and her siblings get through the ordeal. Grace had gotten mad, at one point sneaking out of their house late at night and bicycling to their dad's new home to throw rocks through their windows. That was why Carol blamed her ex-husband for all of Grace's outbursts and bad relationships, in particular any relationship she had with a man older than she was. Truth was, there'd been a few, but Caitlin, as much as she blamed her father for many things, tended to think that Grace's personality had been formed long before the Christmas when their father had left home. Caitlin went to the motel's window and stared out into the half-empty parking lot. A gull skimmed by, just a few feet above a parked Suburban. It reminded her she was in a seaside town. Just 2 days earlier, Grace had been alive here, maybe falling for another man. Bill's son Harry, of all people. And it had been Harry who found her body. How was he not a suspect? He must have been at least somewhat upset at Grace and her role as his father's mistress. Mistress. The word almost made Caitlin laugh out loud. But that was what her sister had been, right? Nothing more than a mistress to a man old enough to be her father. And she'd gotten killed because of it, despite the detectives asking questions as though there might have been some other motive for Grace's death. The whole thing was lurid, and she hadn't been surprised to see the news vans gathering outside of the police station earlier. She began to have a conversation in her head with Grace, something she'd done her entire life. "Can you believe it? You were murdered." "I know, right?" Grace's voice, so real in Caitlin's head that a feeling of utter desolation swept through her that she'd never hear that voice out loud again. Caitlin, throat aching, focused on the mental list again. She repeated the items from her earlier list, adding, "Get something to eat at the terrible-looking diner across the street." Then she added one more item. "Find and talk to Harry Ackerson." Chapter 23. Then. Jake Richter, born and raised in Manassas, Massachusetts, was the son of a German immigrant named Peter Richter, a truck driver who made deliveries for a fishing company in nearby New Bedford. His mother, Jocelyn, half Portuguese and half Quebecois, had cleaned fish at the same New Bedford company. They went on 3 dates before getting engaged on their fourth. A year later, they were married and expecting their first child. After Jacob's birth, a labor so traumatic that she made sure to never get pregnant again, Jocelyn quit her job, occasionally picking up house cleaning work for the summer residents who owned 5-bedroom cottages down at the beach. During his interminable childhood, Jake and his parents spent every evening together in the cramped middle apartment of a brown triple-decker in Manassas town center. They didn't own a television, but listened to the radio every night, Peter steadily drinking brandy from a water glass while Jocelyn would eat Nabisco waffle creams and work on her needlepoint, sometimes talking back to the radio, but seldom, if ever, speaking to her husband or her son. Peter Richter rarely spoke either, and when Jacob started kindergarten, he was so stunned by the sheer amount of chatter, not just from the other kids, but from nervous Ms. Soares, a first-year teacher, that he refused to speak. Suspected of retardation, he was held back a year. But by the time he reached middle school, Jacob, now known as Jake, was regularly getting high marks and had learned to insinuate himself into conversations with the other kids in his class. Boys talked about baseball and comic books and liked to make up stories about getting into fights, while girls just liked it when you paid attention to them, mainly through teasing. Both boys and girls talked about television, For a while, it was howdy doody. But by the time Jake was getting ready to leave Manasset Middle School for the regional high school, it was all candid camera or a new show being aired in the afternoons called American Bandstand. Jake asked his parents only once if they would consider buying a television. His mother said that she didn't think she'd be able to keep doing her needlepoint and watch television at the same time, and his father said that television was a waste of money. So Jake learned to secretly listen in when kids talked about the shows they watched. He memorized what they said, and that way he could pretend he watched TV as well. When he was 15 years old, one of the women whose houses his mother cleaned asked her if she knew anyone who could take care of the grounds in the fall. Jocelyn volunteered her son, and in October of that year, Jake began to work one day a week at Mrs. Codd's shingled cottage, two streets from the shore and with a two-acre backyard to take care of. His job was primarily raking, getting rid of the leaves from the massive beech trees and maples that lined her property, but Mrs. Codd always had one or two small jobs for him to do around the house, taking down the storm windows or moving the patio furniture back into the garage. She'd hover near him while he did these chores, always with a lit cigarette. Her hair, cut into a bob, was dyed a platinum shade of blonde. Her face was heart-shaped, dominated by wide-set brown eyes made larger by heavy streaks of light blue eyeshadow. She couldn't have been more than 50 years old, at most, but her two children were already away at college, and her husband, an insurance executive in Hartford, came out to the house only on the weekends. Like some of the kids at school, and not at all like his own parents, Emma Codd talked non-stop to Jake, even sometimes accompanying him as he raked up leaves, telling him about her two boys at college, or asking him what kids these days were like, what music did he listen to, what did he watch on television.
"We don't have a TV,"
he said to her, the first time he'd admitted that to someone. "Well, that's probably a very healthy thing, Jake, although I don't know what I'd do without it in the evenings. It's not that I watch it all the time, but it's nice to have on just for the company, you know?"
"My parents don't really care about my health. It's just that my dad is too cheap."
Jake had figured out that Emma Codd, who could talk about anything, liked to talk about other people's shortcomings most of all. "Oh, I don't know about that," she said. "I bet he's just worried about your eyes, is all. But really, if it has to do with money, I'd be happy to just let you have my old television set. One of those things they made just after the war. Looks more like a radio with a screen in it, but I'm sure it still works. Or you're more than welcome to come over any time you want in the evening and watch some television with me. I wouldn't mind the company." Jake knew that his father would never accept the television, especially from Emma Codd, a woman he often referred to as that rich bitch, and whose husband he called Cuckold Codd, using a word that Jake didn't understand. But he did mention to his parents that he'd been invited to watch television at the Codd household. He knew there would be no objection. His was a cold and loveless house, but that also meant there was freedom. He could come and go as he pleased. His parents never expressed any desire to have him around, and his father even grumbled sometimes about how much the weekly food cost had increased now that Jake, who'd grown 4 inches in under a year, was eating so much. Jake started going to Emma Codd's house weeknights after supper time, only after the dishes were cleaned, dried, and put away, his nightly chore, and only if he'd finished all his homework. In her large living room, Mrs. Codd and Jake would watch television together while she drank a Tom Collins and talked over most of the programs. She would move around the room, freshening up her drink, or stretch out on the sofa next to Jake, sometimes brushing his legs with her bare feet. Back at home, under his covers, he'd allow himself vague and dirty thoughts about Mrs. Codd, which would always end with him feeling repulsed by himself. Jake had limited knowledge about sex, not having learned anything from either of his parents, and having absorbed a fair amount of misinformation from kids at school. but in all that misinformation, he'd never heard about a kid having any kind of relationship with an adult. It never occurred to him that Mrs. Codd would want to have